Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery, and on behalf of East County Magazine and KNSJ, we want to wish you and your family a very happy Labor Day. The first National Labor Day was adopted by Congress back in 1894 and signed into law by President Taft. It followed a tradition, began by the state of New York in 1884, and later several other states. The day honors the contributions of American workers to our nation. Labor Day is always commemorated on the first Monday each September. This year is a special occasion for the labor movement, since it marks the centennial celebration of the U.S. Department of Labor. The first Labor Department secretary was a former coal miner who helped found the United Mine Workers Union. Established 100 years ago in 1913, the Department of Labor has helped usher in many reforms and protections for workers that modern-day people may take for granted, such as the 40-hour work week, overtime pay, workers' compensation for ill and injured employees, the Equal Pay Act for women, laws to prevent discrimination based on race, outlawing child labor, enabling those with disabilities, and adopting OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, to protect workers from dangers in the workplace. Across the nation, labor representatives continue to fight for fair wages for workers. Here in San Diego, labor won a victory earlier this year when the City Council adopted a prevailing wage ordinance for workers on city projects. Some local fast food employees also joined in a protest to call for higher wages to support their families. As we celebrate Labor Day this year, far too many workers remain unemployed, however, including many teenagers and over 700,000 veterans who served our country. But there is some good news on the economic front. Federal policies to encourage American companies to bring manufacturing operations overseas back home to America, implemented by the Obama administration, have proven to be effective. Biz Journal reported earlier this year that a recent poll of manufacturing executives found 37% of U.S. companies with production plants in China have either brought work back to America or were strongly considering doing so. Apple and Airbus are among the major corporations that have brought some manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. In fact, in the past 3 years, 500,000 manufacturing jobs have been created in the United States, reversing a downward trend. Plus, a total of 7.3 million new jobs have been added in the private sector in the last 41 months as we finally move out of the recession. On this Labor Day weekend, we thank and congratulate the many hardworking Americans who are the backbone of our nation's economy.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ. What's polluting the waterways in Ocotillo? Residents want to know. Thursday's storm brought an unwanted surprise to the town, where floodwaters swept through this desert community carrying a white, foamy sludge. You can see a video of this sludge flood on our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Our photographer Jim Pelly lives in Ocotillo. He and other residents say they have never seen the white, foamy sludge before the Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility was built. What is it? He asked. What effect will it have on our sole source aquifer? The underground aquifer provides the town's only source of drinking water. Pelly also wants to know if the contaminated water will be harmful to animals. It has been so dry out here, he says. I'm sure all of the wildlife is very thirsty and will be drinking this water. Ocotillo is located in Imperial County, just over the San Diego County line. But the impacts of a wind project there are of concern here in East County, with a similar wind project proposed in McCain Valley on federal public lands. This isn't the first time this has happened. In July of 2012, just over a year ago during the wind project's construction, a flash flood washed a similar-looking white foam through the town. It coated the streets and the yards where children play. You can see our prior story on that at our website. Officials initially balked at disclosing what that substance was, but after East County Magazine advised that we would pay for testing if officials didn't turn over the records, an Imperial County official finally informed us that the substance was a chemical used for dust suppression by the wind project developer. That substance is flammable when it dries out. That fact struck fear in the hearts of residents during a wildfire that engulfed mountains behind Ocotillo in July last year, just days after the big flood with white flammable chemical residue still on the ground dangerously close to homes. No cleanup was ever ordered. Could Thursday's flood of white foam be a dust suppression chemical reappearing in waterways 1 year later? Or is it something else? One troubling possibility is that the substance found this week could be runoff of herbicides sprayed shortly before the storm. The herbicide was approved by the Bureau of Land Management to suppress non-native mustard weeds brought in by vehicles at Pattern Energy's wind project. Spraying of the neurotoxic herbicide was done over the objection of Ocotillo residents. Is that herbicide now polluting public waterways and perhaps even threatening the aquifer? Still another possibility is that two massive dust storms that struck Ocotillo last week may have blown in other contaminants from Arizona, where the storms originated, or picked up contaminants in areas east of Ocotillo, such as the highly polluted Salton Sea. An East County Magazine investigation has found an apparent link between the resurgent of Dust Bowl-era scale storms and construction of industrial-scale wind projects and desert solar projects across the Southwest. Scraping bare the desert soil on thousands, even millions of acres, collectively for these projects destroys topsoil. Just as industrial-scale agriculture destroyed topsoil in the 1930s, causing the dust storms that turned the Midwest into a dust bowl, forcing millions of people to move away from their homes. Today's dust storms also pose a new hazard, releasing deadly valley fever spores trapped beneath desert soils. Valley fever has risen to epidemic proportions in Arizona and California, the Centers for Disease Control reports. Residents near wind farms now face a no-win situation, confronted with dust as well as dust storms harmful to human health, as well as pollution from chemicals used by wind energy developers to control that dust. Jim Pelley gathered up a gallon of this mysterious white sludge, which resembles snow blanketing the desert after Thursday's flood. He has turned it over to an environmental officer in Imperial County who said he will send it out for testing and analysis. Meanwhile, residents in Ocotillo and other residents living near wind farms across America are wondering just what's green about so-called renewable projects that pollute communities, cause dust storms, and endanger the health of human beings and wildlife in the area.
This is Janice Mork, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world. This is Janice Mork. I'm here with Reverend Eric Smith, who is the keynote speaker at Grossmont College commencement this year. Reverend Smith is a former sailor and has written From Crack to Clergy, Provoking Thoughts. Why did you decide to write a book about your experience turning around from your addiction?
Thank you for that question. It's a very good question, and it really goes to the heart of who I am and why I wrote the book. And it's about caring for others. Getting caught up into drugs and realizing that I was powerless. I saw so many other people that perhaps were not thinking on the same line I was. I was constantly thinking about how can I get out of this? Even though I was in it, I didn't like it. And once I got out of it, what could I do to help millions of others of different sizes, races, gender? It didn't matter. Drugs touches everyone. And so I thought that what better way to do it is to put my thoughts into writing, put it in the book form, and put it out. So therein lies my reason for doing that, so that I could reach others and then help others that perhaps had not come to the point that I did in knowing how to exit, if you will.
What kind of help did you get when you decided to turn around? And do you recall how long it took until you were finally healed?
Yes, there were many factors or many people or agencies that played a role in my getting over my drug usage. Family was critical, people, that love you and care for you, constantly talking with you, pointing things out and counseling you, trying to guide you. That was very helpful. I've even tried a couple of programs, the NA program and one other private program, and different things work for different people. However, those programs really didn't work for me, but what worked for me was searching of self, looking in to my life, who I really am, and what am I doing, what's my real purpose in life, and ultimately, who has made us, coming to the point that I realized that man is so fragile, man is so weak, and that something greater than us has to be out there. And seeking those means and answers, I come to the conclusion that there has to be a God or has to be some source of greater power that has made us. We haven't made ourselves. So I yield to that power source. And that's what basically helped me, meditating, reading God's word. I've been clean now since 1991. However, in answer to your question, totally healed, it didn't leave me instantly. You know, sometimes people say I was instantly healed. Well, that's not the case here. The taste was there still in my mouth for about 2 years. The appetite would somehow rise up again, but I just simply fought it and never looked back. So I would say it took about 2 years before I was really totally healed and not thinking about it, not having that taste to come up at all.
And when you wrote your book, was it difficult for you to recall the times that you were addicted?
When I wrote the book, no, not really, because doing my drug usage, having thoughts of how I could get out of it, it was almost like I came out of my body while I was doing drugs, because I was there doing it, but I was never really happy doing it. It was like I was running from something. And I was able to come out of myself and to look at myself in the midst of that demon, if you will, of doing drugs, and said, I don't like this. I don't like me. So I would make notes and write little notes on various papers. And so it was very easy for me to recount what I was going through and what I felt like, what it tastes like, and what I saw, because I made not only mental notes, but I also had written notes. So while I'm writing the book, I was able to recall relatively easily.
Oh, wow. Okay. And after the Navy, what was the greatest challenge that you faced in life?
That would have to be drugs, although I'd faced many challenges. When you say greater, that would be the most recent challenge. But coming from the South and being a black man and living in poverty, and parents couldn't read or write, I couldn't talk, I used to stutter terribly. So there was always some challenges. I've always had to overcome obstacles. But in answer to your question, the greatest one after leaving the military would have to be drugs. And this is why also I think that every person, regardless to their age or race or sexual preference or whatever, would benefit from my book, which is entitled From Crack to Clergy, Provoking Thoughts. It deals with how I've overcome those various obstacles, dealing with real issues, dealing with real people.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. You can read Reverend Smith's story at www.eastcountymagazine.org. You can also buy Reverend Eric Smith's story at Amazon.com or OperaHouse.com. His book is called From Crack to Clergy, Provoking Thoughts.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. Smoke from the Rim Fire burning in Yosemite has reached the valley floor. The Rim Fire has charred over 222,000 acres, and CAL FIRE now lists this as the fourth worst wildfire in California history, based on acreage burned. The fire could potentially surpass the 2003 Cedar Fire, which scorched over 273,000 acres in San Diego County and remains our state's worst wildfire ever. The Rim Fire is not likely to surpass the Cedar Fire in two other measurements of its disastrous scale, however. The Cedar Fire still holds the record of causing the most deaths, 14, and burning the most structures ever, 2,820. By contrast, the second worst fire in both lives lost and structures burned was the 2007 Witch Creek Fire, which ranks fourth in the state's history in acreage burned. But San Diego's 2007 firestorms actually included 7 separate blazes burning at the same time. If you combine the damage from those 7 fires, then the 2007 firestorms destroyed 369,000 acres, nearly 100,000 acres more than the Cedar Fire. All told, those fires burned 13% of the total land mass in our county back in 2007. The 2007 firestorms in San Diego also resulted in the evacuation of 500,000 people. That's more than any disaster in U.S. history at the time. 10 people lost their lives in the 2007 fires here, which also injured 23 civilians and 89 firefighters. The 2007 fires burned 1,600 homes, 800 outbuildings, and 253 other structures, second in damage only to the Cedar Fire. The state's list of the top 10 worst wildfires includes a 3rd firestorm in San Diego County, the 1970 Laguna Fire that charred over 175,000 acres, killed 5 people, and burned 382 homes. San Diego's 3 major fires in 1970, 2003, and 2007 rank as the state's 3 worst fires ever in structures lost. As for lives lost, only one other fire in California has claimed more than 2 lives, and that was the Iron Alps Complex fire in Trinity County back in 2008. With drought, climate change, and strained budgets impacting firefighting resources, however, the prospect of future fires topping the records of San Diego's destructive firestorms remains all too possible. Today, as we approach the 10th anniversary of the deadly Cedar Fire, we'd like to replay a recent interview with Dr. Mark Hansen, who escaped with his family in the middle of the night as the fire engulfed Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon, where many lives were lost that night. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery. As we're approaching the 10-year anniversary of the deadly Cedar Fire this fall, I am here today with Mark Hansen. Dr. Mark Hansen and his family live in Lakeside in Wildcat Canyon. He's here to tell us about their harrowing experience the night of the Cedar Fire. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam, and thank you for all your ongoing efforts to assist potential fire survivors and past fire survivors for all these years.
Yeah. Well, it's a very, very important issue that's certainly near and dear to our hearts here. Now, Mark, you are a survivor of the Cedar Fire. The night that it occurred in late October, you were working late, thankfully, for many of your neighbors. It was 3 o'clock or so in the morning. What was the first inkling you had that something was wrong?
I was in the south turret of our house, but I could smell smoke. There just seemed to be a lot of it's a heavy wind. I called the fire department. They assured me not to worry. It was in Ramona, moving north to Julian. And I called again 20 minutes later, and just to double check, they said, "Oh, no, it is. Just go to sleep."
Now, they told you to go to sleep.
Yeah.
And when you looked out your window across the lake below your house, Lake San Vicente, what did you see?
Flames 300 feet high.
30-story building.
My wife did. My wife looked out, yeah, because she asked me. I said, "Oh, they said it's in Ramona going north." And she looked out and said, "It's in Ramona all right, but it's only just across the lake. It's only..."
How far away is that?
Quarter of a mile.
A quarter of a mile, and they told you
right.
to go to sleep.
Right.
And then what did you tell the 911 operator?
I called and told her that there's been a terrible mistake, that the fire is approaching rapidly, and they weren't aware of it, but would check into it. And
did they ever activate reverse 911 for your community?
Oh, they did, but before the next fire, not
but not in
this
that
one.
Fire. So
no.
People there in the middle of the night had absolutely no warning that this inferno was roaring toward them. So what did you do next?
I called neighbors, and we called, and neighbors left messages, spoke to 4, and then all the lines went out.
The phone lines burned.
We spoke to said, "Oh, you can come watch it over at our house." And my wife screamed that this isn't like that. You look out the window. And that person barely got out, was the last person to get out. And they had a truck, so the fire didn't catch his car on fire. At the bottom of Muth Valley Road, there were about 18 cars there. And people thought maybe they had hauled them out, but that's how badly they were burned. The firemen miraculously got everybody out of the cars.
Wow.
Kicking and screaming because all their belongings were in
it. I've heard it burned tires.
Tires burned the tires. And very shortly exploded it and burned the cars, but not while anyone was in it.
Now, some of your neighbors, you did a great heroic job of getting a lot of people out with these middle-of-the-night mm-hmm. phone calls as you were trying to evacuate your own family, probably grabbing very little on the way out. Were you able to salvage much?
Oh, no. My wife took what pets she could, an iguana, one cat, her favorite cat, ran to the basement. We couldn't find it. We got the dog. The horses all got out. We took them across the way.
And you had a young daughter at the time.
And Hillary, yeah, she's the only one who got any pictures, and she was a freshman at El Capitan High School at the time. She got her ASB shirt she'd need and her volleyball uniform and her homework and some pictures. Mm-hmm. I got all the bills. My wife grabbed her brand new Mac laptop, but all the files were on the old one. She realized she made a bad choice.
So were you seeing this fire? How close was the fire as you were driving out of this Muth Valley Road?
It was only 100 yards away.
Oh,
in our guest house was an artist, Ryan Mims, and he didn't want to leave his artwork behind. So we got that together. We felt for sure the guest house would burn and the large house would fireproof. It's going to still be there.
Fireproof. It had steel framing, didn't it?
Yeah, not the case. It was just the reverse.
Wow.
Of the large houses, almost all of them burned. Of the guest houses, about 50% remained because the flames coming at 60 miles an hour would ricochet off. 3,000 degrees.
3,000?
2,000 less than Hiroshima.
Wow.
So nobody was able to stand out with the garden hose. And what they found, one person did, they only found steel tip boots. One neighbor, all they found was his teeth. His brother came down from Oregon to identify that. Others tried to drive to the lake. They only found bones and charred cars. Very, very hot. It was a 100-year fire.
Muth Valley is part of Wildcat Canyon.
Yes.
Which was the scene of the great tragedy in this fire where 12 people lost their lives.
Correct.
12 people. Did you know these? Were these friends, neighbors, Mark?
7 of them I knew very well because they were close neighbors.
That had to be just devastating for the community afterwards. What was it like coming back in there after the fire?
Well, the first thing is that you were alive, and many of the neighbors weren't. The second is the surprise at all the rules about fire, because this fire was a firestorm. It was no hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And it was surprising what did or didn't survive. All the young horses all died because they either tried to charge the fire, run away. Mm-hmm. The older ones who dodged it lived a while but had lung damage. The folks who had cleaned up their yards, thought they would be safe, didn't make a bit of difference.
So all that defensible space in such a monstrous fire. Although we should add, defensible space does help.
It does.
In many places,
in the 2007 fire, it helped a great deal. And the key is if it's under 1,600 degrees. After 1,600 degrees in a firestorm, all the bets are off. It's blowing up rocks. Your little sprinkler system on your house will just be a steam bath. The fireman came up, and one of the fireman was a former student, and he was going to save my house. But it was a steam, 10,000 gallons would delay the burning for 30 seconds. And the key was, if people had shutters, it may have helped. But if the fire hit the house twice, it would melt the windows. It's inside. It burned in. Maybe if it's fireproof, it burned in 8 minutes instead of 6.
Now, you and your family were fortunate that you had insurance and you were able to rebuild,
I understand.
How have your neighbors fared who lost their homes?
Those who did not have insurance coverage that was replacement insurance didn't fare well because all of the court cases were lost by the homeowners. The insurance company won them. And that was, of course, 6 and 7 years later when the verdicts came in. So that was gut-wrenching.
How did they lose? I don't understand.
The laws were written in the favor of the insurance companies and the lobbyists. And, of course, Heartland Coalition, the group I'm executive director of, got grants to help people rebuild, especially their home businesses. We did seminars in productivity communication.
I remember you raised funds also for cars, computers, to help a lot of these people get back on their feet and rebuild their lives.
Of all the people who applied for SBA loans, and we did that too, we were one of very few that got them. It takes about 4 years. It's a lot of paperwork. And so many people, if they didn't have enough insurance, maybe they thought they could get it from an SBA loan, but they always check on the tax returns, and they got these threatening letters that they had underreported their income. It was rough in many ways.
Very important question. What has changed since this fire? Have certain things improved you know, do you think if another fire like this comes roaring through that the reverse 911 system will work? Or that firefighting services will be there? That's another thing. There were no firefighters there in time.
No, there weren't. The firefighting services had helped. The reason this got so out of control, there were lots of fires in the area, and our planes that are normally at Ramona were in Riverside or San Bernardino.
So do we have dedicated aircraft here now? Do you know?
We have more. We have some, and there's a helicopter from the city that was available. I don't know if it still is. It was up to a couple of years ago.
Now, were you evacuated during the 2007 fires also?
We were. We were evacuated.
And,
we,
and how did you get word? Were there reverse 911
reverse
calls?
Reverse 911.
So that's improved.
Yeah, we weren't that concerned because the foliage hadn't recovered from the 2003. See, the 2003 fire was more like a fire in Montana or Colorado because it had never burned. It was huge ponderosa pines, 500-year-old oak trees, very hot.
Now, you lost a stable also, and I remember you telling me an interesting story about what you had to do to prove it was even there to the insurance company.
Oh, yeah, that was the tack room. The fire was so hot that it just, it was like Flash Gordon had been there and disintegrated it. And it was puzzling to me. But I walked 50 feet to the west, and all of the paint from the stable was there on the ground. And then we went back. We found the cornerstones, and we found one little metal top for the saddle horn and where it was made. It was a really nice saddle.
And that was the evidence they needed because they were denying this claim at first for a stable.
Well, the poor guy, you don't see fires like this very often in Southern California.
No, you don't.
So he expected to see some evidence above the ground that there was a building, and initially there was none, but we found it.
Now, a fire not only takes a toll financially, physically, but also emotionally. Are there still scars, emotional scars from this fire that you and your family and your neighbors have to this day, Mark?
Absolutely, and many of them have to do with a lot of people. All the horses died up where we were, except for four we had on the other side who were older, who actually would look at where these little cyclones were coming and dodge it, but they didn't live too long. So many people were very sad about that. Many people in these support groups we had were their cats. Many people...
And you lost a cat as well.
Yeah, my wife has a little graveyard for it, and other pets have been there. And then, of course, if someone lost a family member, that it was far over anything else. We personally didn't go through that, but our neighbors did. One of our neighbors lost, they were all gone. It was the husband, the wife, and the children. So disappeared, and it was a terrible blow in that way. Another thing that happened is there was a lot of behavior from some insurance companies, not others. Others were terrible. Some went in and told people they were underinsured, but they signed all these papers. We'll cover you to this amount, a little bit, just about half of what they needed to really rebuild. The other problem had to do with people stealing all the copper, all the piping. They'd try to irrigate, and the water would run out. All their trees died. If any did leave, very few did. Another problem had to do with the financing. Many of them got more money than they'd had before to rebuild, but people came in with all kinds of great ideas and investments, and they lost it.
So there's a lot of... predatory actions out there.
Absolutely.
And
of course, when I said great ideas, they turned out not to be great. Some were not fraudulent, but it was they were high-risk things like second mortgages at the time, and those people lost all their money. So another sad thing, they didn't want to have all the money just in a money market account. Interest rates were low. So that's a lesson of being conservative in tough times. And people were vulnerable, and it's not everybody's recovered yet.
No. Thank you very much for coming in and sharing your story with us, Mark. It's a very long road to recovery after these fires, and we appreciate you taking the time to tell us about your experience.
Yes, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from the people we helped at Heartland, over 158 people. So I learned a lot from them and made a lot of close friends.
Certainly, as the old saying goes, that if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it.
Right.
And so my hope is that with having these special reports and talking to the people that have been through the Cedar Fire, we can learn from our experiences and be better prepared before the next firestorm strikes our region.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Dozens of protesters rallied outside the Sempra Energy Building in downtown San Diego last week to bring attention to AB 327. Activists say a provision in the bill, which is expected to be voted on by the end of this week, would allow utilities to charge customers a new flat fee. Sierra Club spokesperson Masada Diesenhaus says basically this change will decrease the financial advantage of using alternative energy.
By adding the charge and by leaving the tier system further open to changes by the California Public Utilities Commission, what they're doing is they're taking away the incentive that people currently have to conserve energy. Because if you're going to have another chunk on your bill, there's just so much you're going to be able to reduce your bill by saving energy. Of course, when people install solar, it's come down a lot, but it's still an expensive proposition, and people want to know that they can get it paid back over a certain period of time, and this is going to increase that time.
The Diesenhaus said there is something residents can do to make sure this change does not take place.
We're urging people to contact their senators and to just ask them to vote no on AB 327 and to explain that it would increase their cost, and nobody wants to see their electricity bill go up.
That's right.
And we really don't want to do things that are really contrary to the goals that California has put out and that it's been very successful at so far.
An easy way to find out how to contact your senator is to just go online to findyourrep.legislature.ca.gov. Again, that's findyourrep.legislature.ca.gov. Then just type in your address. East County Supervisor Diane Jacob was also at the rally showing her opposition to AB 327. Jacob said by adding an expense for customers who use solar power, the bill would, quote, discourage people from putting solar on their roofs and discourage energy conservation measures. The people who would be most affected by the passing of the bill, those people who have been installing solar in order to not only reduce their bill but also actively support clean energy, were represented at the rally by several solar users. This gentleman explained how AB 327 will affect him.
The changes proposed by AB 327 to net energy metering threaten the foundation of rooftop solar. For me, it turns my solar investment from one that should pay back before I retire into an expensive loss.
AB 327 would make a number of changes to the way SDG&E, PG&E, and SoCal Edison charge for electric. The most troubling of these changes would allow the utilities to impose a fixed charge of up to $10 a month on the energy bill of every residential customer. Stephanie Donovan with SDG&E says it's not about discouraging the use of solar, but more about fixing the rate structure, which in its current state, according to Donovan, is not sustainable. Reporting for East County Magazine, I'm Mike Hancock.
You can sign a petition showing your opposition to AB 327 at www.saveoursolar.com.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lane with your baby mine. Her hand and she holds yours, and that's a very good sign that she
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with an education update. The California Department of Education has released its 2013 report on API tests for school districts and individual schools in California. For the 10th year in a row, the Grossmont Union High School District has shown improvement in its API, which measures how well students are performing on both the California Standards Tests as well as California High School Exit Exam. The Grossmont District's API increased by 14 points to 769. In addition to significant growth at the district level, two of the district's high schools demonstrated dramatic improvements. El Cajon High School, which has a very diverse and economically disadvantaged student population, increased its API by a whopping 73 points. The school exceeded all of its API growth targets, with results from the California Standards Test reflecting improvement in all subject areas. Monte Vista posted a gain of 29 points. Monte Vista made substantial gains on both the CST tests as well as the California High School Exit Exam, and the school was among a very few high schools statewide to have met all of its targets under No Child Left Behind accountability rules. The district also improved 28 points overall among students with disabilities, 38 points among the socioeconomically disadvantaged students, and 30 points among Hispanic and Latino students. Santana, Valhalla, and West Hills all exceeded the state's growth API targets, scoring above 800, with Santana scoring 814. The district's two charter schools, Helix and Steel Canyon, also scored high at 804 and 798, respectively. Other schools had gains in key subject areas. These improved test scores came despite budget cuts that proved challenging for the district.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
So we're here at Santee Lakes, and we're at the Spray Ground. This looks like fun. Yeah, Miriam?
It does. There's lots of little kids in there splashing around, getting all wet.
And why don't we have one of these for adults?
Good idea, Mike.
Looks like fun.
It does.
Hello, I'm Mike Hancock. We're on the road in East County. We're here with Jonathan Skinner with Santee Lakes. How you doing, Jonathan?
I'm doing good, Mike. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for taking some time out to talk to us today and tell us all about what's happening at Santee Lakes.
We're really excited about our property and what we do here. We're a community asset. We've been out here since over 50 years offering recreational opportunities for the community. And when I say the community, I'm not just talking Santee. I'm talking about La Mesa and El Cajon and Alpine. They're part of that 750,000 people that we have come here every year.
That's a lot of people coming to Santee Lake. So, Jonathan, can you take us back to the beginning of Santee Lakes and tell us how it all started?
When it was the Santee Water District, there was a challenge that we had. And basically, we do reclaim water. The Water District does reclaim water. But we were shipping it down to San Diego, and we had an opportunity either to maintain that or to find a way to handle the water ourselves. And Ray Stoyer, the general manager at the time, decided to make it a way that we can take care of recycled water here, and the recreation came as an afterthought. We started actually working with the environmental community to get it approved to have reclaimed water used for recreation, so that's really, really exciting.
So it's a green operation, the reclamation of the water?
Yeah, we actually have a very big plant north of us, and it recycles 2 million gallons of water a day.
This is Miriam Raftery, and I understand this has become an international model. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, when you look at reclaimed water, a lot of times they just take it and, you know, use it for irrigation and other sources. What we were able to do is find a way to make it for recreational use. When Ray Stoyer started this project back in the 50s and 60s, he was able to get approval to have limited contact with the water, but also use it for recreation. So if you take a look in our general store where we're just at, you'll see pictures of, we had sailboats. So we will be bringing back. Exactly when, I'm not sure, but we will be bringing that back. We have fishing that started back then. We currently stock over 38,000 pounds of fish between trout and catfish a year.
You also added camping.
If you took pictures of our old campsite, it was very primitive. Well, and now we're on, I would say, part of the state-of-the-art of camping. We went from under 100 sites to now over 300 sites. We've also included cabins. Three of them are floating, and seven of them are on shore.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the floating cabins.
It was a labor of love from our previous director, who is now our general manager, Alan Carlisle. He was approached, and the park was approached, from people who didn't have tents. They didn't have trailers, but they wanted to come camping. So through a lot of research and support from the board of directors, we found a way to have cabins, which are basically trailers that are stationary. We have them on Lake Seven. It's absolutely beautiful. So three of them are floating cabins. We actually have a dock that goes up to them, and they're floating. And then we have seven land cabins.
So they're anchored.
They don't just travel around, which is a very good question, because when people ask the reserve and they say, well, am I going to be floating? You're going to be floating, but you're going to be stationary.
It'd be hard to get a good night's rest.
So you won't get seasick.
Well, we haven't had anybody get seasick yet.
What else is in your dream list there for Santee Lakes for the future?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, Miriam, because right now we're doing a master plan for the park. The last one we had, which was the 21-21 plan, came up with a lot of great opportunities and projects for us, which we completed. But currently what we're looking at is expanding our recreational opportunities. Some of the things that have been talked about is a zip line.
Hey.
We want to do some shore restoration, which is going to increase some of our picnicking opportunities, some retrofits that we have for the back of the park, upgrading things that have been here since, not the beginning, but since the 70s.
They also have various things that you can rent to go see the lake.
Some of the amenities we've had for a couple of years is our pedal boats, which is really, really big. They either have it for two people or five people. And it's primarily right now on Lake 5, which our goal is to also put them on Lake 1. It's one of our biggest lakes. One of our newest additions that we got in 2012 are our Surreys and our bikes. Now, if you haven't seen a Surrey, there's a song about it with a Surrey on top. So it's a two-person or four-person bike, and you can actually fit as many as six adults and two kids up front. It's a great way to see the park up front, but it's also great exercise, and you'll be able to see that when you go out on it.
Right. Yeah, that sounds good.
And so we're going to take you on a tour and go pedal around the lake and look at some of the sights.
Okay, so we set off on the Surrey, and here we are at Santee Lake, driving around, and we're going the wrong way.
Not at the lake, though. How do we break it?
Oh, the brake's right here. If you see something bad about to happen,
just yank it. Okay.
Yeah, cool. We want to go to the left.
Break.
Is this the way we're supposed to go? So we're not supposed to go on the sidewalk. This thing really moves. Let me know if you want to drive.
Cool. Here we go.
I don't think we could go uphill anyway, even if we try.
We are on the road in Santee Lake.
We got a wave, too.
Yeah.
I think we're going to park it right here.
Jonathan, tell us about some of the fun activities that you've got planned this summer out at Santee Lakes.
Well, starting on June 21st, we start our movie series, and we call it Movies by the Lake. It's on Lake 5, absolutely beautiful.
Bring the popcorn.
Definitely bring your popcorn. Yeah, it's like a drive-in movie, and we encourage people to bring their picnic baskets and their blankets. We have games for the kids, and we also, at certain ones, we have bands who come and play. There's a special concert that is here for the Rotary, which is Concerts at the Lakes. That one, they have two bands, one called Ramshackle, which play a lot of the newer music, and then they have four lads from Liverpool. And that is a Beatles tribute band.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us today. And where can people get more information about Santee Lakes?
Well, they can go to our website, which is www.santeelakes.com, or they can visit us on Facebook and like us on Facebook, or they can call us at 619-596-3141.
We'll be back again next week with another edition of On the Road in East County.
You might think an organization called MAD wouldn't have much to be glad about, but more police on the streets through this holiday weekend is certainly one thing that pleases them. Mothers Against Drunk Driving National President Jan Withers says high-visibility law enforcement on the roadways is a proven way to reduce drunk driving deaths.
So when it's advertised and people know about it, it's a deterrent. And then when they see the officers on the highway and they have the sobriety checkpoints, it's interesting because it literally does reduce those fatalities by 20%.
Instead of being frustrated by delays during sobriety checkpoints, Withers says drivers should be grateful.
If they happen to go through a sobriety checkpoint, please say thank you to the officers for helping to protect us.
Law enforcement throughout the state will be out in force through the Labor Day weekend looking for impaired drivers as part of the annual Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
This is Caprice Harrison bringing you a true tale from East County's past, a colorful chapter from our history that may soon be revived. Ernest Dahlman, Chief Executive Officer of Pacific Imperial Railroad, has announced he has signed a 99-year lease with the San Diego and Arizona Eastern Railway Company and is raising funds to restore and operate the Desert Line tracks through mountains and deserts in San Diego, Imperial County, and Baja, Mexico. He hopes it'll link up with the trolley and train lines in San Diego, as well as a transcontinental railway route to the east. The route in East County includes the rugged Carrizo Gorge, once a pinnacle of engineering accomplishment on what early engineers called the Impossible Railroad. The idea for the railway started with Edward Harriman, who controlled the Union Pacific Railroad and Southern Pacific lines. He partnered with sugar mogul John D. Spreckles, who, despite numerous ownership changes and calamities, led the Herculean effort to complete the line. Groundbreaking was held in 1907, but soon after, a depression caused funds to dry up. Then Harriman died, and his heirs canceled the contract with Spreckles, who raised the money on his own. In 1910, the first passengers were carried to Agua Caliente Hot Springs, but the next year, revolutions broke out in Mexico, and workers left their jobs until the rebels surrendered. Next, Southern Pacific sued Spreckles, trying to get back $3 million it had advanced, but the suit was later dismissed. World War I broke out in Europe. There was no money for railroad construction. The line, it seemed, was cursed. In 1916, the worst floods ever to strike San Diego at that time washed out dams and roads, flooding Campo Creek. An engine derailed and sunk in the mud. In 1917, the U.S. government seized all the major railroads to fuel the war effort, and construction halted. Spreckles went to Washington, D.C. and convinced the government to grant an exception, arguing that the line was vital for defense due to military installations in San Diego. Finally, construction began on the toughest stretch of tracks, the steep and rocky Carrizo Gorge. Plans called for 17 tunnels along the 11-mile stretch. A cave-in killed a workman who was buried in the collapse. Work was also slowed by the influenza epidemic worldwide, which sickened many in the construction camp. Finally, the work was complete, and the Gold Spike Limited made its run from San Diego to the Carrizo Gorge station. Spreckles jumped down, pulled off his coat, and drove in a solid gold spike on November 15, 1919. In its heyday, the line carried passengers to the Agua Caliente racetrack, a popular spot during Prohibition, and provided a vital connection from San Diego to Arizona. But the tale doesn't end there. Rock slides delayed trains repeatedly, sometimes for weeks at a time. Flash floods, a fire that burned for 4 days, and even a hurricane wreaked havoc with the tracks. The railway also faced competition from automobiles as the horseless carriages gained popularity. After Spreckles' death, the heirs sold off their interests, and ultimately, the California Public Utilities Commission granted permission to shut down the line. The last train ran its final run in January 1951. You can still ride the rails on an old-time train from the line at the Railway Museum in Campo. But someday soon, East County residents may once again hear the whistle and the roar of trains across the line that traverse some of our region's most rugged and spectacularly beautiful terrain, if Ernest Dahlman succeeds in his dream to restore the line.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine. It's shaping up to be another wild weather week in San Diego County as a subtropical storm lingers over our region. The potential for thunderstorms will persist over our mountains and deserts through Friday this week, though sunnier conditions are forecast west of the mountains, so it's a good time to head to the beach. Gusty winds, rain, lightning, and hail are possible inland, so be prepared for some more wet and wild weather in East County.
Welcome to Vines and Wines with your host, Greg Maness of the Maness Vineyards Estate.
That's Greg Maness from Maness Vineyards here on East County Magazine Live. And we're going to introduce you to another very informative and what I feel is a very affluential person in the wine and vines industry movement. Ladies and gentlemen, Don Rutkoff. Don, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Greg. Happy to be here.
Give our listeners a little story of what your life's all about.
Okay. I'm originally from the East Coast and moved to California like many people did, seeking fame and fortune in the early 1980s. And I lived in San Diego for a while, got a degree in finance from San Diego State University. I moved up to the San Francisco area, and I got an MBA from San Francisco State University, and I worked for Bank of America for about 10 years doing budgets and financial analysis and risk management. I liked wine, and I thought, you know, I'm here in the Bay Area. Napa's not that far away, so why don't I see if I can go to work in the wine industry?
Now, did you do some specialty schooling and training in viticulture and AVA?
Yes, I was able to go back to school, and I took some of the seminars that they offer at UC Davis on sensory analysis and chemical composition of wine, and then I went to school in the classes at Napa Valley College. It owns 2 5-acre vineyards in the heart of Napa. We used to grow and sell grapes to Stag's Leap wine cellars, and the school offers 3 different AA degrees and about 30 or 35 different courses in the wine industry. So it's a very extensive program.
So you got a lot of information and a lot of training out of that. You have started a new career down here and got some of the colleges kind of buzzing. Can you tell us a little bit about where you're teaching these college-level classes about vines and the wines movements and the new ordinances?
Well, 2 years after moving here, I wanted to get a little bit more work under my belt, get more hours, and I thought, you know, San Diego looks like a pretty good place to grow, and it certainly is a place where people are drinking a lot of wine, and we have a big hospitality industry. So I called up my friend Steve, who runs the wine program at Napa College, and I asked him what he thought about the idea of taking some of the classes and transplanting them and using them down here, and he said it was an absolutely great idea. So I started sending emails and making phone calls to the 4-year colleges, but especially all the community colleges, in the hospitality programs, in the science programs, in agriculture, any different department I could think of, if they wanted to start teaching wine classes. And here I was, I've got 2 college degrees plus college education on top of that, and teach the science of viticulture, how the plants grow, why they are what they are, how to harvest them, selling, the business side of wine. And after, it took a little while, but finally got Cuyamaca College. Cuyamaca had actually called Steve at Napa College 2 weeks before I did and asked him if he knew of anybody that could teach down here. So when I called Steve, not only did he say it's a good idea, but he said, hold on a minute, let me dig up this email or phone call or whatever, and he put me in touch with Cuyamaca, and I got in touch with them and put together a proposal. It took about 5 or 6 proposals to finally hit the right one, the right match between what the continuing education program was all about, or what they needed from an instructor and what I could teach.
Right, and so you've taught a couple classes out there now. Your current program is about how to obtain boutique winery licensure and the bylaws and in-laws and legalization of all those different steps. Amazing stuff. What do you got planned for this upcoming fall? What's your next class?
We're going to teach 2 classes in the fall semester here at Cuyamaca. One is going to be at Wines of the World. Grab your passport. We're not going to be tasting, unfortunately, but we will be teaching people how to look at a French wine label, a Spanish wine, you know, Italian wine, how to look at it, how to read the label, how to understand what it is and compare it to a California wine. And then the second half of the fall session, I'm going to teach the business class again that I'm finishing up right now. It's called Creating a Successful Winery Business.
Nice.
And this class touches on federal law, state and local law, the county ordinance for having a tasting room. Touches on sales and marketing, using the internet a little bit, and some accounting issues. So it's an all-around general purpose class, what's involved in being in the wine industry, what it takes to get started, and where to go.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Don Rutkoff, from all of us here at East County Magazine Live and Maness Vineyards, thanks for tuning in today. Don, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate the interview.
You've been listening to Vines and Wines with Greg Maness, proprietor of the Maness Vineyards Estate. Visit the website at manisvineyards.com.
An Amera Media production.
You
It's back to school time, and the San Diego County Animal Services is urging students to hit the books and relax with a study buddy kitty at your side. County Animal Services' three animal shelters are overstocked on cats, so for a limited time only, adoption fees for cats that are 6 months and older are just $5 through the month of September. Yes, you can adopt a cat for just $5. County Animal Services Director Don Danielson says, "Our three county shelters are packed with gorgeous cats right now, and we figure since school is back in session, now is a great time to adopt the perfect study buddy. One of the 10 best habits to be successful in school is to have a study buddy. Our cats will let you study in peace and quiet, review your work, and offer helpful critiques without a word of criticism," she claims. While cat adoptions are just $5, kitten adoptions are $58, but there's a special for that, too. Under the Better with a Buddy program, you can adopt one cat or kitten, and any second feline adoption is free. All animals are neutered or spayed, microchipped, and vaccinated before going home with new families. For more information on adoptions at any of the three county animal shelters, call 619-767-2675. Or to see photos of the animals up for adoption, visit Animal Services website at www.sddac.com. That stands for San Diego Department of Animal Control.com. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.